What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Damage Report. Not with John Iadarola today or tomorrow or the following day, but Francesca Fiorentini, your favorite stepmama dragon, MILF dragon, I don't know, whatever we're going with these days. Good to have you here. What's up? John is out, but he needs the break and rest. And thankfully, I've got Dan Evans, Dan from the internet here. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Whenever there's a bat signal out for John needing a vacation, sometimes I will answer the call. How reliable.
I don't even know how he's doing. Yesterday, his voice was slowly giving out. So everyone check in on John, because I haven't done so. But hopefully he's okay, and hopefully he's having a good relaxing break away. In the meantime, everybody, like and share the stream, all right? Let's show Dragon Daddy that we know how to behave when he's gone. Obviously, we're gonna get into a lot of things today. We're gonna get up to no good. There's mostly bad stories. Some updates, obviously, on the Roe v. Wade fallout. Again, somehow Uvalde is a story that just keeps on getting worse. And so we're gonna look at what the police are doing to a mother of children who went to the school that was suffered a mass shooting. So anyway, with that, Dan from the internet, are you ready to do this?
Not as ready as John would be if you were hosting on like 3 cups of Robitussin, but ready nonetheless.
That tussin. All right, well let's jump into this.
Can the administration expand abortion access or abortion services on federal land, meaning provide the access on federal land that might be in and around states that ban abortion?
I think that what is most important right now is that we ensure that the restrictions that the states are trying to put up that would prohibit a woman from exercising what we still maintain is her right, that we do everything we can to empower women to not only seek, but to receive the care where it is available.
Is federal land one of those options?
I mean, it's not right now what we are discussing.
So that is Vice President Kamala Harris in her first one-on-one interview since the Dobbs decision came down, overturning Roe v. Wade, and being interviewed by Dana Bash, being asked specifically about an idea that a lot of Democrats, progressive Democrats specifically, have been floating, like Senator Warren, like Representative Ocasio-Cortez, like Representative Ayanna Pressley, which is, hey, why not set up clinics on federal lands? One of many different emergency measures that could be taken right now. And there you heard the vice president say, not something they're looking into, not something they are gonna do. What are they going to do? What are they suggesting instead? Here was that big hard pivot into a phrase I think we've heard a lot in the last few days. Take a look.
But I will say that when I think about what is happening in terms of the states, we have to also recognize, Dana, that we are 130 odd days away from an election, which is going to include Senate races, right? Part of the issue here is that the court has acted, now Congress needs to act. But we, if you count the votes, don't appear to have the votes in the Senate. Well, there's an election happening in 130 odd days. I'm taking, for example, thinking of a Senate race in Georgia or North Carolina. There's the Senate race coming up just in a couple weeks in Colorado. And we need to change the balance and have pro-choice legislators who have the power to make decisions about whether this constitutional right will be in law, right? We say codified, mm-hmm. Put it in law so that there will be no ambiguity about it.
And I want to ask.
So if you didn't get all that, it was basically vote harder. There's nothing we can do currently, even though currently we do have the majority. Dan, I wanted to get your thoughts on this response from the second most powerful person in the country, if not the world?
It's definitely startling, and it echoes what a lot of people first reacted to, or how first reacted to this news of the Supreme Court officially announcing their overturning Roe v. Wade. Of course, it was leaked a month earlier than that. But this realization that the Democrats are not really going to help anyone when it comes to this stuff. Like the Joe Biden ran on making sure that Roe v. Wade would be into law, that like the right to access an abortion would be into law. Okay, whether that was possible or not, Joe Biden should at least acknowledge that he ran on that campaign promise before asking for more votes again, because he got a lot of votes presumably on that and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. But Democrats need to show they're willing to fight and willing to act right now. The part about, oh, well, there's a Senate race in Georgia coming soon. There's a Senate race all over here. Well, there are not Senate races in states like Indiana with Joe Donnelly or Pennsylvania with Bob Casey or West Virginia with Joe Manchin. These are all senators who are Democrats who have no interest on doing anything as it relates to abortion.
Right, and specifically one of those things would be to eliminate the filibuster so that something like codification or making Roe v. Wade law, making the right to an abortion law could go forward. And Vice President Harris also, and take a look at this pretty skillful evasion of the question on the filibuster, but essentially is echoing what the president himself has echoed or said, which is there's gonna be no carve out even for this when it comes to the filibuster.
Do you support eliminating the filibuster in order to pass federal legislation for abortion rights?
Right now, given the current composition of the Senate, the votes aren't there.
But would you use the bully pulpit to say, yes, I support it?
Well, here's the thing. I understand why you're asking the question, mm-hmm. but the reality of it is, we don't even get to really answer that.
As the vice president, as the president of the Senate, do you have a position on, I know you don't have a vote on it, but do you have a position on whether the filibuster should be eliminated?
I think the president has spoken on that issue. And
he said and more, he kind of left the door open. Is this where he was leaving the door open to?
I think that he has been clear about where we stand on this issue of reproductive health and what the president and our administration have within our toolkit to do. And so far that's what we've been pursuing.
Oh, just, I watch that and I see the shortest leash, the vice president being held on just a short little like, you say anything, you're gonna be pulled back. You get like you can tell she may want to say more. Yes, I believe in amending the filibuster. Yes, I believe in changing the rules. These arcane, ridiculous parliamentarian rules that are holding back progress on this and so many other issues. But even if she weren't, I feel like she's not making a convincing case that the executive branch is doing all that it can. I don't know, Dan, what were your thoughts on that sort of evasive answer?
I'm really happy that Dana and, I mean, as long as people like Charlemagne the God even are pressing Kamala Harris on questions that she's dodging, then I'm glad that at least Dana Bash is doing this as well. But I'm glad that she pushed her into a corner and saying, okay, as the president of the Senate, as the vice president, what is your opinion on doing all these things?
Right.
And I thought the Democrats understood this game. One of the only smart things I really think Pete Buttigieg just said is that Democrats will be attacked whether they do the thing that fights for people or whether they don't do the thing that fights for people. So I think that Kamala Harris is still playing this game where, okay, as long as I don't say that I'm going to buck Senate rules or even acknowledge the fact that with what's going on with Jeannie Thomas and Clarence Thomas, there's a legitimacy crisis with the Supreme Court right now, to not acknowledge that from one of the highest statues of the executive branch, one of the three branches of government that theoretically is supposed to check the other two.
Yep.
I don't know. It screams of what people fear, but unfortunately understand, was that Democrats are not equipped or even willing to be equipped to do any major thing to protect abortion rights in this country, with the exception of a select few Democrats who are speaking out.
Right. And she's not even willing to call out the powerful, anyone else, which it's so clear what this extremist Supreme Court has been anointed to do, like how they've been fast tracked into their positions to do. And here we see it. And she starts off this interview even laughing about that, which I gotta say, the vice president's like sort of nervous laughter is one of the most, not just unappealing, but something that instills such little confidence in her or the president or that anyone is taking this seriously at all. And so there's that. And the one thing she did say, we could throw this up, she say they're looking into possible vouchers travel voucher specifically for women to receive abortions. Now, I just want to note, we noted this yesterday on the show, that defending the right to travel is the barest of the bare minimum you could be doing at the moment. But hey, I think in this, when it comes to this administration, it feels like they are much more comfortable with words and wishes that your heart make when you're fast asleep, which is also a line from Disney, but I feel like these guys kind of like echo it. So there is that. I also just want to say, in terms of the Senate is important. I don't think any progressive is downplaying how critical it would be to make gains in the Senate. But the GOP only needs to flip one seat in order to have the majority. One. And not only do Democrats have to hold on to all of their seats, we have two essential Republicans as senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. So again, you could see how very fragile things are. So again, I'm not saying that it's not important to hold on to Senate seats. I'm not saying it's not important to bring out the vote to defend Raphael Warnock's seat. But you look at Warnock, for example, who runs on, you know, $2,000 checks, they're only $1,600, you know, who runs on all of these promises around voting rights, around racial justice. Has he been able to get anything that of that done because of the Democratic leadership? No.
And at the end of the day, like, you're one person, we're always talking about these one or singular political actors, but politics 101, get elected, do things you said you're going to do so that you can continue to keep power as long as the term limits allow for. The Supreme Court does not have term limits. The people in the Senate have some of the longest term limits of anyone in elected office at like 6 years or so. It's not just on Raphael Warnock to stand up to the Democratic Party for whatever reasons, because he needs to stand for the Democratic Party before the Democratic Party loses itself, before it loses its power. It's something to do to save the party long term. If you see something that your own organization is sabotaging itself, it's your duty to stand up, not for that organization really, because screw the Democratic Party establishment getting us here in the first place, but to save the constituents, the voters, the people who are going to be actually affected by these things and not this. I actually had to mute myself when I screamed hearing Kamala Harris use the phrase vouchers after remembering the primary when she was talking about, oh, if you are middle class and you're working and you went to college and you can get this special program for qualifying to have your student debt or like any of these other things. Like, I'm so sick of this like means tested crap as opposed to actually not making America a laughing stock in the rest of the world as far as our backwards laws go. I'll leave it there.
If you make between $18,000 and $21,000 a year, but have no dependents and also drive a Nissan, you could get a voucher to travel for an abortion, but only to certain states.
On Tuesdays,
of course, today. Thirteen states around the country have trigger bans when it comes to abortion rights, which means that as soon as the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, those trigger laws and trigger bans immediately go into effect, effectively banning, if not all, but most abortion in those states. Louisiana and Utah are two of those states. However, judges in both of those states have temporarily blocked the abortion bans. So a state judge in Louisiana issued a temporary restraining order Monday, barring the state from enforcing its ban, leading to the immediate resumption of the procedure. Hours later, Utah Third District Judge Andrew Stone halted the state's trigger law effective immediately under a 14-day temporary restraining order requested by Planned Parenthood Association of Utah. So you've got 14 days in Utah. Let it be known, shout it from the rooftops. If you know, maybe just see. I don't know, maybe you are pregnant, even if you're probably not. Obviously, this is a last ditch measure and effort, and it's very good that Planned Parenthood and others are, again, this is the importance of utilizing the courts, the importance of actually clogging this stuff up in legal proceedings. But 14 days is nothing. And this will only protect people who were immediately seeking abortions and were denied. So Judge Andrew Stone, this is again the Utah Third District judge, said there is irreparable harm that's been shown while issuing the temporary restraining order that will be in effect for 2 weeks. Lawyers for a clinic, he said that, lawyers for a clinic that sought the order said they had 28 women awaiting an abortion appointment on Monday. Abortion rights advocates are coalescing around this strategy of asking courts for temporary injunctions that at the very least can allow abortions to proceed in the short term. One of Louisiana's three clinics already said on Monday that it would reopen. So this is very important. I mean, I think some of us think, you know, why wouldn't you just stay open? You know, what's there to lose? There's a lot. There could be a lot. And these are clinics that perform abortions on the daily. They're very comfortable with it. They know how critical this kind of care is. And yet they're not financially equipped to deal with massive amounts of lawsuits that could be coming their way. Thoughts on this minor reprieve, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, we'll take anything we can get here with allowing people to would be most immediately affected by this to have at least some reprieve from it. Because the stories that I don't know if you heard of, like when the Supreme Court case ruling came down, people were just so immediately distraught and upset, and like appointments had to be canceled that day, that moment. Mm-hmm. And I feel for people like in states with all these trigger laws where it's going to be like harming surprise to happen in Louisiana and Utah in the court level, because usually it's kind of said that the courts have this sort of like conservative bent to them. But I think about states like Arkansas, for example, or Tennessee, where you're essentially locked around all the states surrounding Arkansas, especially all the states geographically surrounding you are also states with trigger laws. And the states that aren't that have politicians who would like to further restrict abortion access from what is already there. So it's again, it's increasingly hard for women, but also people who are poor, working class, who need to travel to these places to get services that are rights in most other developed countries in many states in this country. Like, thankfully, there are states that have anti-trigger laws, so to speak, that basically once these kinds of striking down of Roe v. Wade take effect, they only further strengthen their protections for the rights for an abortion. A lot of the states have this in their constitutions, but we can't have this patchwork where half of the country is in civilization and half the country isn't.
Right. I mean, that's why, like, it's a long shot. It will be a long haul, but including abortion rights in the Constitution, hey, that could be a thing. You know, I mean, and this is, if it's not explicit enough, if like the right to privacy, the right to choose when you become or if you become a parent, if that's not explicit enough in the Constitution, let's make it explicit. I mean, this is the rollback that is happening on some, like, the Constitution must be interpreted when the white slaveholders, males, property owners, which were again were people, decided on these random set of laws. I mean, it just, like, at this point, it's like the Ten Commandments in my book. Like, that's how abstract, like, that kind of originalism. But hey, funnily enough, these right wing Christian nationalists also believe in the Ten Commandments and every word in the Bible. Anyway,
their interpretation of it as well, because of course, yes, there are Christians out there who have more realistic, rational interpretations of the Bible who are being crowded out and shouted out by these evangelical maniacs, essentially.
I mean, to be honest with you, like, I think that Trump was a moment for a lot of Christians who saw that he was lying through his teeth, saw that he was definitely a quote unquote sinner, according to, you know, interpretations of their book. And yet I wonder where they're at right now in terms of the people who are like against Trump, but also, you know, might be Christian. I know obviously there are grassroots movements. Obviously I'm thinking of Reverend William Barber. There are many, many, many like left progressive religious folks, but you wanna hear from them now, because evangelicals are taking this as a win, not just for their own extremist movement, but supposedly on behalf of their God. And so I'm like, where are y'all at? You know, I could really, I'd like to hear from you. I did wanna just mention that there is Meanwhile, there's a rush on contraceptives. So CVS and Rite Aid are now rationing emergency contraceptives after demands in spikes. CVS said it will temporarily limit the purchase of Plan B and Aftera to 3 packs per customer. A spokesperson said Monday, while the drugstore chain has, quote, ample supply of the products, both online and in store, the cap is meant to ensure equitable access and consistent supply on store shelves. Rite Aid is also limiting purchases, to 3 per customer, a spokesperson said Monday, also citing rising demand. Walgreens website showed Tuesday 2 emergency contraceptives, Plan B and Take Action, were out of stock for shipping, but available for pickup and same day in certain stores. A spokeswoman said Monday that purchases were not limited at this time, as company could still meet the demand in store. Quote, we're working to restock online inventory from ship to home. The grocery store Kroger notes on its website, Plan B is not available and that in-store stocks are low. Meanwhile, the price of tampons through the roof, also scarcity there. Scarcity in baby formula, scarcity in Plan B. How funny, all the things that women need generally for their reproductive health. But this limiting of 3 per person, I don't know. I look at that and I actually think that might be a good idea. Dan, am I wrong? Should you just be able to like just grab it? I mean, you know, people are just giving it out to their friends anyway, so.
Yeah, I'm a little bit mixed on here, because I'm pretty sure like all of these pills will be used for people's reproductive health, which people should have the freedom to do. But I mean, in situations like when COVID started, when we had limits on how much toilet paper you could buy at one time, it was for a reason. It was to make sure that more people could have access to it. It's to make it, because this could very quickly be a scarce thing. We had these demand side runs on supplies overall, and we know we're in an economy that is in an inflationary period caused largely by a supply shock. There's a lot of demand now for different things, including gasoline, for example, and the supply is not fully recovered from COVID. And so we are now in the situation where prices are skyrocketing and we're currently trying to deal with that. So now is the right time to where we are dealing with the like fact that people are doing runs on this. Because, yeah, we do want this to be something that people have access to.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also one of the things that I'm like, look, if there are runs on it, just like the, you know, executive branch did when it came to baby formula, although I know that's been a slow rollout. But you also saw the way that COVID tests were distributed, and you can easily put in your address and information. Not initially. Initially, it was difficult. It got a little easier. And then in a couple of weeks, you know, I personally got 4 COVID tests sent to my house. Amazing. What about some Plan B? What about some Plan C? What about I could just do that and the federal government can overstep Congress and make sure that people have their healthcare needs met. But then I realize, oh yeah, we live in the United States, healthcare is privatized. We never get our healthcare needs met.
And Kamala Harris just mentioned earlier today that the Democrats are not going to do anything to help with that. So, I mean, we're kind of on our own. We'll vote our way through it.
All right, back on the damage report. Francesca Fiorentini here with Dan Evans. We got more news to take you through this Tuesday. Let's get into this next related story to abortion rights. Instagram is not only been taking down images of women breastfeeding, of course, for a very, very long time, because somehow that's inflammatory slash gives life. But now they're deleting posts that have to do with abortion rights and the abortion pill. Instagram has deleted some posts and limited at least 2 hashtags related to abortion services, according to some of the platform's users, and warnings that have been added to certain topics. The platform also briefly suspended and then reinstated an account belonging to an abortion services local platform. Unlike normal searches on Instagram, searches for, quote, abortion pills and mifepristone, a popular abortion pill, on Monday did not immediately yield results. On the hashtags for the same terms, a message was displayed that recent posts with the tags, quote, are hidden because some posts may not follow Instagram's community guidelines. What are those guidelines? You're not allowed to spread information about healthcare? about now that we have a Christian nationalist Supreme Court that's taken away our rights. We're not allowed to share that information. It's almost like big tech should be broken up and we shouldn't have censorship. And this is the actual censorship, not the stuff that the right wing or Candace Owens or other people who consistently get the number one post on Facebook are talking about. So a little bit more on this, Dan, before I can get to you. The limitations placed on the hashtag means the most recent posts with the tags, which are usually found in a separate tab, aren't available for users to see. So for anyone searching for up-to-date information on the hashtag pages, that means they will have to scroll through older, more liked posts first, including anti-abortion posts. Tech news website Motherboard reported Monday that Facebook, another Meta-owned platform, is also restricting certain posts about abortion pills and resources. Abortion access platform Abortion Finder said its Instagram page was suspended Sunday morning. Fun. Oh, good time to do that. Tight. I want to say that this is not the first time, and I alluded to the breastfeeding censorship, but this is not the first time, and nor is Instagram or Meta, or Facebook, whatever it is now, Zuckerberg's thing. They're not the only ones that do this. Of course, YouTube, Google, what we're on right now, if you put abortion in that headline, your video will be demonetized. These are tech companies who, at a time of need, they may be pledging to help their own employees get access to healthcare, but they are actually limiting the speech on spreading that information to people who might not have the luxury of working at one of their tech companies. Dan?
Yeah. Yeah, so much there. So like, just for those employees, by the way, because of the American healthcare system that further ties those employees to working at those companies, because oh no, you lose your job, you lose your reproductive rights. That's just a wonderful secondary aspect here. But then you look at these companies and what policies they're putting in place. And it's so funny to note that all the Republicans who cry about big tech censorship and how the left is constantly censoring what they're allowed to say, while at the same time they are dominating their platforms and constantly 6 to 8 of the top 10 most shared things on Facebook in any given day. This is actual censorship of people's trying to communicate how they can protect their rights. I mean, I think trying to put myself in a business sense here, Meta is trying to shield itself from legal repercussions of potentially operating in states and having the stuff on their platforms. But this is why, to get nerdy for a moment, why Section 230 exists, why these social media platforms are not supposed to be responsible for what, legally responsible for what their users do. So they could just take a laissez-faire approach and say, oh no, we're just gonna let our users do what they want to, as long as they're not, you know, causing any harm or breaking any laws, so to speak. And I think you can get careful with what you do on a state by state basis. We know these social media platforms know how to do state targeting. So there's so much that these companies could be doing, but Meta especially is cowering to the right because they have such an influence in advertising and lobbying in Washington, D.C., that's their goal right now, is to get on good graces with people in Washington on the right and the left, but especially the business favored right. So when it comes time for people to even come near the idea of breaking up big tech monopolies, there are enough people on Facebook's side and they can't look at Meta and say that, oh, they're pro-abortion or anything like that. That's not an arrow they have in their quiver. It's strategic, but it comes at the cost of reproductive rights.
Yes. No, I think that's a really good point, that they try, and I mean, again, you can't be neutral on a moving train. Corporations try to stay neutral, but we ultimately know, and this is what I'll push back on, that they're not, because we know they make bank on the right wing rabbit hole algorithm. They make bank on conspiracy theories. And I can't help but think of that recent pandemic we're still living through, COVID-19. How long did it take for those posts about all the fallacies around COVID-19 not being real, around taking ivermectin, or yeah, you should drink bleach, or whatever it was. What did we talk about? Some kind of silver that I somehow learned yesterday that people were ingesting and died. Like, it took so long for companies like Meta, companies like Google, to actually put up warnings. not just take down, but put up warnings about like correct vaccine information. And so I wonder why they can't also do that here. I do want to give, let's give Meta a chance, okay? So Andy Stone, who is the communications director, writes that content that attempts to buy, sell, trade, gift, request, or donate pharmaceuticals is not allowed. Content that discusses the affordability and accessibility of prescription medication is allowed. We've discovered some instances of incorrect enforcement and are correcting these. So admission that some of these groups that have been barred from posting, like a group actually based in Texas called Plan C, who's giving information about the Plan C pill, as well as some of the others we mentioned, that they're being that's being rectified. But again, like this is they're so quick to take this kind of information down, and yet everything else can stay up. And I just want to button this up by saying, like, while look, I have a podcast, I have a YouTube channel at Franny Fio, follow me. That's the woke thing to do right now. So I can't put abortion in the title without my YouTube video being demonetized, right? Or limited monetization. That means you can't run ads on that. Great. So I avoided that, right? So then I go to my video and I press play. What's the pre-roll ad I get? It is a dude well into his 30s going, "So I'm an abortion survivor." And come to find out, they're running anti-choice ads on my video that I'm not allowed to say abortion on. So they're making money from anti-choice organizations while at the same time preventing information from being spread about actually what's going on with our rights. You can't make this stuff up.
Oh no, but they are constantly censoring conservatives. It's conservatives that are constantly in trouble on these platforms. It's ridiculous.
Oh
yeah,
no, the real victims, real victims. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Okay, so we got some updates on January 6th. Let's get into this. The January 6th committee said that it was taking a little bit of a recess, that they weren't gonna have another hearing. They've had 5 hearings so far. They said, we're good until after July 4th. You know, let's have a barbecue, let's hang out. JK, in fact, they're holding a surprise hearing today in about 20 minutes. If you're watching this in the future, obviously, it's happened. But anyway, why are they doing this? Why are they coming out of recess? It's like they're doing more work than Congress normally does. You know, usually going on break whenever anything important happens. But here was a tweet yesterday. It's official, the tea is spilled. This is the first emergency hearing of the January 6th committee, and they promise to reveal newly obtained evidence. I did want to note that since the hearings have started, the committee said that they've been inundated with lots of new evidence. This might be part of that, it might not, it is unclear, but we think we know what this is about, which is about a new documentary on Discovery Plus. Sorry, I've just had to, somehow I think we all have to buy Discovery Plus right now, because the news comes as the House Select Panel has been examining footage from documentarian Alex Holder's upcoming 3-part Discovery Plus documentary, Unprecedented, that had access to Donald Trump and the White House at the time of the insurrection at the US Capitol. The committee, which met last Thursday, only said that Tuesday's hearing is to present recently obtained evidence and receive witness testimony. A source tells Deadline, however, that the hearing is almost certain to include footage from Holder's doc, which the committee only recently received within the past week. They were trying to find their login to Discovery Plus. It was a whole thing. There was lots of like underscores and capital letters and numbers, and it was weird. And they shared the login, and then they finally got it.
I heard that someone had to call their mom for the first time in a couple months, and they had a long conversation about keeping in touch, but eventually they got the password.
Totally. They were like, "Mom, third drawer down, you know, it's a notebook. You write everything down in it. It's probably the same password you use for everything else, and that's why you get phished all the time." What is interesting about this documentary, and we covered this on the main show last week, but so Alex Holder actually had the full consent of the Trump family and White House to do this documentary, which is generally in the past how they've gotten burned. But again, a family of Fredos never learns. They basically love collabing with the feds. This is just them being like, yes, I kill people. No, obviously that's a mafia reference, but so Holder said that he received unparalleled access and exclusive interviews with Trump, his children, his son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Vice President Mike Pence. CNN reported that Holder's attorney Russell Smith said his client cooperated with the committee because there were inconsistencies in statements made for the documentary and those told to the committee. So are we lying under oath, perhaps? Could it be Satan? I'm sorry, I've got a lot of old references today. There's a lot more which I really like. So what appears of interest to the panel is whether Trump and his children had planned to somehow stop the certification of the election on January 6th, a potential violation of federal law, and to force a contingent election if Trump lost as early as September. Among the conversations captured on film was with Eric Trump. Ooh, Eric getting a little starring role, getting a little cameo on the phone. Eric Trump on the phone to an unidentified person saying, according to one source familiar, hopefully you're voting in Florida as opposed to the other state you've mentioned. Now, that is not actually about overturning the election, but it does go to show that pretty much every Republican has a separate residence in Florida. We know this, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump himself. Everyone's like, oh, I live in a blue state, but I vote in a red state. Cause when you've got money and you want political power, that's what you do. Two homes.
If this were, what's the point of shoe on the other foot theories? But to take like, oh, a secret call with the president's son talking to someone about voting in two states. If this were a Hunter Biden story, like we'd be talking about Laura Ingraham's response to it for three blocks of the show. But like, I'm really happy that we are getting this stuff from this documentary. I love that these hearings are very thorough. I think they're starting to have, I was hearing some analysis by someone else the other day that like, because there aren't many Republicans involved in these hearings, there's no ability for a lot to be funneled to Fox News for there to be counter programming. Yeah. So they're stuck between this balance of saying, oh, it's not important. And if it was, and they were calling emergency hearings for some important big insurrection type thing, don't worry about it because what they're saying is nonsense. Not that I'm paying attention or anything, but I know enough to say that what they're saying in detail is not true and Trump is fine and everyone, oh, people asking for pardons and indictment, pardons the last moment, that's totally fine. That's a totally normal thing people do all the time. I asked for six pardons last week. Just relax. They can't have it both ways. And I think it's starting to hopefully penetrate that audience of people who were on the fence of even January 6th being a horrible moment and potentially a dark day in American history.
I really wish I could cue up the video of Eric Trump crying at the Biden inauguration. It is one of the videos I have on my desktop that I go to when I am sad. And then seeing him cry makes me happy. Do you guys have those videos? It might be like a cat video. For me, it's Eric Trump crying. But I also feel like the entire family was upset because they knew everything that they had done to illegally prevent that inauguration from going forward. It's not just Eric Trump. It is Ivanka Trump who, remember, to the select committee, to the January 6th committee, said that she was convinced by Bill Barr, former Attorney General Bill Barr's statements that no, Trump had lost the election. She says, yeah, that convinced me. But it seems like that this documentary is showing otherwise, that she actually was not convinced. And here's the thing, you only speak off the cuff and openly with a documentary filmmaker, two things. One, you're an idiot and you somehow think this filmmaker is on your side and that you somehow think good documentaries are just when like an American flag is billowing and then like an eagle passes and then you're like, yes, we stole the election because America, you know, and you're like, yay, that's a great doc. Because you don't watch docs. You don't know what a documentary is. You don't. So that's one. But number two, they thought they could do this. They thought they could pull this off. That's the only reason they would openly speak to someone, to a journalist effectively, about what they were doing, is because if they thought that they would be reinaugurated, they would be staying where they, you know, put, you know, they wouldn't have to move all of their crap out of the White House. Last thing, this is Graphic 7. Holder also testified to the Select Committee. The sources said about the content of the interviews, Holder interviewed Trump in early December 2020 at the White House, and then twice a few months after the Capitol attack, both at Mar-a-Lago and his Bedminster Golf Club in New Jersey. Now, notably, you guys, there's one person missing from the January 6th hearings, and that's Donald Trump himself. We have not seen a word from him. He, I don't believe, was asked to testify, has not testified. But we got the documentary, and we got him speaking off the cuff to someone who he thinks is gonna make him look real good. Because again, don't watch documentaries.
I mean, Donald Trump thinks that speaking off the cuff for himself works well in his favor in general. It seemed for a point during his administration that his Twitter account, he just didn't care about it at all. So I'm sure any moment where he is telling on his own rotund behind is a good moment for TV, let alone for potential justice. Well, I know we have TV 14 rules. I'm being careful.
Rotund behind, diapered booty is what I like to call it. Very, God.
Sorry for that image in the morning.
Forty-six migrants were found dead in the back of a trailer in San Antonio on Monday. 12 adults and 4 children were taken to local hospitals with heat-related injuries. San Antonio is a major hub, being about 150 miles from the US-Mexico border. It is a major hub for smuggling of people trying to make their way into the United States. This trailer tractor was found when a city worker at the scene on a remote back road in southwest San Antonio was alerted to the situation by a cry for help shortly before 6 p.m. Monday. Police Chief William McManus said other officers arrived to find a body on the ground outside the trailer and a partially opened gate to the trailer. The death toll again includes 22 Mexicans, 7 Guatemalans, 2 Hondurans, according to Mexican Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard. At least 16 people have been hospitalized, including 4 children. So there were even more people than who, not everyone had passed away. Clearly, they were suffering grave injuries. It appears to be heat related. This is among the deadliest tragedies that to have claimed thousands of lives of people attempting to cross the US-Mexico border. US border from Mexico in recent decades. 10 migrants died in 2017 after being trapped in a truck that was parked at a Walmart in San Antonio. In 2003, 19 migrants were found in a sweltering truck southeast of San Antonio. So again, San Antonio being one of those main hubs, and this is not the first time, but as Aaron Reichlin Melnick says on Twitter, reminds us that 2022 is the deadliest year at the border ever. At least 46 dead in just this one truck, but hundreds have already sighted crossing the border so far this year, including children. I think he means died. And with renewed rise in boats from Haiti, mass casualty events will become more common. Of course, the right, specifically the governor of Texas, where San Antonio is located, had the utmost respect for the dead. Greg Abbott writing, at least 42 people dead inside a truck carrying migrants in Texas. These deaths are on Biden. These are a result of his deadly open border policies. They show the deadly consequences of his refusal to enforce the law. They are on Biden, Greg Abbott, but they're also on you and every other extremist right winger, because it's not because of open borders. It's actually because of things like Title 42, which is a provision, emergency provision, that says because of the COVID-19 pandemic, no one can seek asylum in the United States. So you cannot say, I fear for my life. I'm being chased by death squads and narcos in my country. I'm applying for asylum. No, you can no longer do that. So I wonder who has blood on their hands. In this case, it's both Biden and people like Greg Abbott. Before I kick it to you, Dan, Congressman Chuy Garcia, this is not lost on him. He says, this is horrific. We need to end Title 42 and fix our broken immigration system so these unimaginable tragedies stop happening. People fleeing violence and poverty deserve a chance at a better life. Que descansen en paz. Thoughts on this?
Those were good remarks from that guy. It's such a tragedy to see these things happen. And it's so disgusting to hear people like Greg Abbott. He's very quickly to quote unquote politicize this. For example, if this were a mass shooting, he'd say, oh wow, 42 people have died and I'm tweeting about politics. Or I'm tweeting about something, someone else like 2 hours afterwards. Oh, what about the families? Let's just talk about the families. But no, yes. this is immigration in Texas. So then he can talk about it and rapidly politicize it. But the Biden's open border immigration policies, not even playing with that. The immigration policies is more or less not changed under the Trump administration. Like you were saying, Biden's timid sort of like trying to take away Title 42 was struck down in the courts. And then Biden didn't really want to fight back anymore because he didn't want to trigger Republicans and, you know, using immigration to add to their already culture war disaster that they're using to rally up their base for the midterm elections that are coming up in just a couple months. Right. So this all stuff is from Greg Abbott. And Greg Abbott, the kind of guy who said, I'm going to start busing immigrants to Washington, D.C. to make a point. He doesn't care about human life. He doesn't care about the reason these people are coming from countries and seeking refuge. This is no longer an American internal immigration crisis. This is a crisis of 50 years of failed neoliberal policies in Latin and South America that are coming home to roost right now. These are bigger issues that people like Greg Abbott, people like Joe Biden even don't want to address.
So I think that's a really good point. And thank you for reminding us that there was an attempt to overturn Title 42, but then once the courts blocked it, they just was like, okay, that's fine. No, that's good. Meanwhile, this is like continues to be one of the most deadly years for migrants crossing the US-Mexico border. And the other thing that I'm reminded of is the ways that, you know, DHS operates under the federal government. And yet ICE, which operates under DHS, is effectively a runaway like extremist organization that operates on its own terms. But if you had a president, if you had a federal government that wielded any more control, I would like to see that institution de-radicalized so that these kinds of incidents stop happening. Because it is incredibly devastating. And we do think of the families. That does it for this hour, but there is more on the other side on YouTube. Go there. See you. Jacob Hawkins says, thank you for your super chat, by the way. I hope DeSantis beats Trump in the 2024 primary. Trump will cry fraud and run anyway, splitting the R vote and the D candidate, not Biden, fingers crossed, wins. Two things on that. I did see a poll, like I was on a website and it was like, who do you think will win in 2024? Joe Biden or, and I was like, Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis. Oh, snap. Even the online polls are asking for DeSantis instead of Trump. I don't know. Yes, I agree. Anything to split the Republican vote. DeSantis is obviously heinous himself. Need I say more? Writes, vouchers call on you to prove on paper what you don't have. However, some don't have the ability to provide that. That is part of poverty. It's also what happens on paper. Need I say more? No, you don't need to say any more. You explain that very well. The amount of bureaucracy that low-income people are strapped with in order to prove that they can qualify for certain programs is just insane. You need, I mean, that's basically what a lot of social workers do, is just help people navigate that bureaucracy. Joe Schmo, let's apply the pro-gun arguments. Laws aren't going to stop people getting abortions. We shouldn't ban abortions. We should ban abortion clinics from having doors so no one can go in. I love it. Yeah, we should get abortion proof backpacks. Severin 71, I just want to say that Francesca has excellent diction and pacing with her speech. Thank you. I do it on purpose so you don't fall asleep. I raise my voice and lower my voice. I change the cadence.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.